you would shed tears for him. And of course, we are not saying anything against the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but for Ibrahim, we are sad and we are crying. Also for some of his companions, when Sa'd ibn Ubadah was about to die, the Holy Prophet cried for him. And that's again, right. Some companions objected, and the Holy Prophet explained that this is very natural.
That's right. So the most original format of the Noha refers to an act of recalling the main events that took place on the day of Ashura, isn't it?
So, I mean, we have the concept of mourning for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now, it can be in different genres and formats.
That's right.
So Noha is one of them, and holding, I mean, processions, beating the chest, and so on and so forth. So the very concept of mourning is rooted in the religion of Islam, in the verses and the narrations. But when it comes to the examples, then we are free to choose the ones which are not, which have those two or three conditions that I mentioned. So when, for example, I mean, writing in and of itself is permitted in the religion of Islam. So the example at the time of the Prophet was writing some animals, for example. And in our time, it would be driving the cars, or, I mean, going to, I mean, using the airplanes, for example. So no one can claim that, I mean, using cars and airplanes and trains and so on and so forth is an innovation, because they were not existed at the time of the Prophet. No, these That's are right. different examples.
Okay.
So the concept of mourning is in the religion of Islam. It can have different examples, and the examples which are done within the framework of the religion of Islam, based on those conditions that I mentioned, are absolutely acceptable.
That's all right. Of course, there is much history among, for example, this musical genre. Mm-hmm. Where does it come from? For example, nowadays we could see the musical bands in the streets of Iran, for example, using drums or cymbals or horns, the rhythms of their music, okay?
Okay.
We can say all these are rooted in a kind of musical genre that were used. And why, for example, that's all right. Nowadays, different cultures, as you said, according to their cultural background, they make music for Imam al-Husayn.
Yeah, as I mentioned, people, first of all, refer to the religious authorities.
Yes.
Because, for example, according to some religious authorities, when it comes to mosques, it's absolutely forbidden to play these instruments.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the viewpoint of some scholars. So I'm not going to go to the verdicts of different scholars. Each and every one of us should refer to the religious authorities. But as I mentioned, to put it into the nutshell, we need to pay attention to those three general conditions for all these formats of mourning.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Karimi, for a nice elaboration regarding the concept of Noha. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. The another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban li Ali wa Husayn wa Hasan. Li Ali wa Husayn wa Hasan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي حسين وحسن
How fashion affect our lives.
You can see more and more fast fashion brands producing more and more clothes.
The fashion industry is one of the most labor-intensive industries.
How does fashion affect our lives and societies?
Have to take different types of drugs to stop them from eating. They want to give energy.
Fashion is all about disposability, about making things very quickly at bigger margins, not caring about the environment as such.
This is the endless drive towards profit.
Fashion is the second greatest environmental disaster.
Who are the fashion moguls who make decisions about the society by controlling the fashion industry? Many societies tend to consume products that might be unnecessary. In fact, they turn to such products just because of advertisements run by fashion designers. This is one of the major viewpoints put forward by the critics of fashionism. Moreover, some critics have gone beyond this and even claim that fashion is used as a tool for imposing cultures and certain lifestyles. Does the fashion industry compel people into materialism and consumerism? Which firms are behind the scenes of fashion markets, for example, in London? And how much is the profit they're looking for in the industry? Follow me in this documentary to find the answers to these questions. The global fashion industry makes some $1,000 billion in revenue each year. However, this figure is extracted from official statistics, and perhaps the undocumented revenue made through smuggling exceeds this number. How big is the fashion industry? Tansy E. Hoskins, who previously worked as a model, wrote a book titled Stitched Up after she quit her job. In her book, she claims that the fashion industry is influenced by capitalism. Hoskins has a critical view toward the profit-oriented aspects of the fashion industry.
And I also wanted to get people to start looking at the fashion industry in a different way.
I think that fashion very much has to be seen as part of capitalism, and because that's the reason why, you know, goods are produced at such high volumes and why wages are driven down and down and down, and is to increase profits for multinational corporations. So for me, you can't separate fashion from capitalism.
Ms. Hoskins is not the only one in the world who takes a critical stance on the profiteering spirit of the fashion industry. This is the headquarters of the War on Want Institution in London, which organizes campaigns against unfair exploitation of workers in England. Today, I came here to visit Ms. Tulsi Narayasamy, who is an economy expert and an activist who has launched different campaigns against exploitation of workers. I asked Tulsi if she too believes that the fashion industry is influenced by capitalism.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the endless drive towards profits, regardless of the exploitation of workers, the human rights of workers, and the environmental impacts. And I think that absolutely is the cornerstone of our economic system, is the race for profits, you know, at the expense of everything else. And we really see this as an economic system gone mad.
How big do you think the fashion industry is, especially from an economic point of view?
So the global apparel industry has surpassed $1 trillion a year, and it's set to, by some estimations, double by 2025. So it's a rapidly growing industry, and you can see more and more fast fashion brands producing more and more clothes each year.
But who spins the wheels of this industry? To find the answer, we better ask people who work in the fashion industry. One of these people is Ms. Orsela Tikas, a renowned fashion and clothing designer in England. She is one of the founders of Fashion Revolution.
I love the fashion house.
The fashion industry is one of the most labor-intensive industries in the world. It is considered to be the second most polluting industry in the world. It employs billions of people. 80% of the fashion workforce is female. It's huge. It has directly and indirectly an effect on something like 1 in 6 in the population are directly affected or employed by the fashion industry.
Is profit the only aspect that matters in the fashion industry, or does it pursue certain goals behind the scenes?
The fact that we stand a real chance right now to act so that it operates sustainably, so that it operates free from exploitation, so that garment workers are paid a living wage, so that the environment is protected. If we do all this now, we really stand a chance to, you know, to have a huge, profound impact on people and planet.
I'm curious to learn about cheap and unethical fashion, which many are opposed to today. That is why I'm going to meet a fashion and clothing designer who is one of the founders of a campaign against unethical fashion.
It's had enormous influence on our lifestyle. I think fast fashion has changed our perceptions about fashion. Most importantly, it's really changed our idea of how much fashion should cost. So whereas 30 years ago, 50 years ago, you could buy, on average for the salary, you could buy a certain amount of clothes, now suddenly we're empowered to buy a huge amount more.
Ms. Orsella, too, criticizes the promotion of fast or unethical fashion. She believes capitalists try to promote fast fashion in order to persuade people into mass consumption.
Fast fashion takes its name from fast food. It implies a fashion that is ready, available, cheap, on demand, on your high street. Whenever you want it, there it is, you can buy it. The reality is that the fashion industry really is a lot about craft, about artisanship, about time, the time it takes to make clothes. And so fast fashion is in antithesis to what perhaps the craft of fashion is.
What it means is the idea of producing collections quickly and cheaply. And it's a very clever retail strategy in the end, because what it means is that shops can sell a lot more, make a lot more money, because psychologically for the consumer it's much easier to buy something at a low cost and buy lots of things than spend a lot at once.
While fast fashion is about delivery now, sustainable fashion, slow fashion, ethical fashion is about taking time. While fast fashion is quite invisible, you know, we don't know who makes the clothes, we don't know anything about the fast fashion supply chain. Sustainable fashion is the opposite. It's about identifying that supply chain. It's about making visible the people that make our clothes. It's about reintroducing the love of craft and handmaking.
The experts I spoke to believe unethical or valueless fashion is a means for profiteers, behind-the-scene players, and economic powers. They believe economic powers in the fashion industry manipulate people's tastes and interests to lure them into adopting certain lifestyles or consuming certain commodities.
fast fashion, the way consumers are sort of addicted to buying the latest trends when they don't really need it, and then just like getting rid of those clothes because the next trend has come out, has really impacted the environment, especially the waste, garment waste, because unfortunately the garments that are being produced by mass manufacturers are not actually ethically produced, they're not sustainable, so they're impacting landfill sites. And we've got, and unfortunately, fashion is the second greatest environmental disaster.
Shamiza Rashid asked me to visit an exhibition to better grasp the difference between ethical and unethical fashion. This small expo was held somewhere in London by an independent designer with the aim of promoting ethical fashion. Ms. Aisha Mustafa is a fashion designer and a severe critic of fast fashion. Although this is a small exhibition, the organizer tries to show that even ordinary needs for clothes can be met using ethical fashion. For example, the producer of these items has not tried to exploit cheap workers or produce cheap but low-quality products, which will only lead to mass consumption and environmental pollution.
Fast fashion is all about disposability, about making things very quickly, at bigger margins, not caring about the environment as such.
Aisha and other experts I talked to about ethical fashion believe that the majority of people don't pay attention to where the products they consume come from and how they're produced. So I decided to ask some of the passers-by around one of London's shopping centres about this issue.
No, because those people are earning a living and, you know, if they weren't making it, somebody else would, so...
No, really.
I'd love to see where it was made, yes.
Thank you very much.
Some people would like to know about the country of origin of the products, rather than the manufacturing companies.
They're coming
and... it's from China, mostly. China, Bangladesh, kind of this country. Well, their labor is cheap there.
Some of those who work in this industry purchase cautiously, like this woman.
Well, I've worked in the textile industry, so I do see where these things come from.
Or this one.
Yes, usually I do, yes. I'm actually studying fashion, so I study, you know, the place of origin and how it matters and sweatshops and the whole Bangladesh Rana Plaza thing, so yeah.
It's interesting that women who work in the industry say they use a clothing item for a long period of time.
How long you use these items?
Usually one season.
As long as it lasts, really.
But others have a different opinion.
For Primark, maybe just 2-3 months.
It depends. Usually the clothes lady doesn't take it that much long. They change it.
How long? Quite a while. Yeah, depending on what it is.
Over and over and over again, lots.
I think there's an increased awareness about these things because of the press coverage and the media. And I think now, before we throw a piece of garment, there's an awareness.
However, statistics show that the frequency of purchase of clothes is increasing. It can be understood that profiteers take advantage of this trend in the best possible way to promote fast fashion. But the promotion of fast fashion fails some requirements for its investors. Sometimes investors do whatever it takes to comply with these requirements. One of the outcomes is the psychological destruction of young models. Many of these models spend years grappling with the debilitating effects of working in the fashion industry. Some of the models manage to survive these conditions after spending a critical period. I found it necessary to speak to one of these victims, who used to be a model and currently works as an expert in the field. One of the experts I'm going to talk to is Ms. Karima Bentaoud. She used to be a model, and in the year 2000, she converted to Islam.
I think the most young girls, they really want to be in fashion because they think it's really glamorous, exciting, you know, like they see lots of magazines and pop videos and they want to be like that girl because they think that girl's getting lots of attention. And I started off as a makeup artist, so that really was behind the camera. And for me, it was more about the money and the travelling. It wasn't about the attention. So that's how I got into working as a mannequin for 4 years in Zurich, in Cologne and Dusseldorf, in Paris and in London. But that was a long time ago, alhamdulillah.
What's your opinion about the behind the scenes in this industry?
Well, it's not good really at the end of the day, because as a beautiful woman, there's a lot of men who want you to be with them, and they want you to be with them as a fashion accessory. Basically, your fashion accessory. They've got a nice watch, they've got nice Mercedes, and so they have to have a nice girl sitting in the car in the Mercedes. It's the picture. They want the picture. And a lot of the times as a girl, you're not really, because the mentality is immature, is you're not really aware of what is going on.
Fashion modeling structurally has the same kinds of characteristics as other kinds of jobs that sociologists actually call bad jobs, like precarious workers in flexible fields, day laborers even, people who don't know when their next paycheck.
Ms. Ashley Myers is another former model who lives in the U.S. She is the author of a book titled Pricing Beauty. In the book, she shares her experiences in the world of fashion and the conditions of modeling. She has revealed facts from behind the scenes of the industry.
Fashion modeling, it's an occupation that actually kind of pushes the way we can think about careers versus jobs. I mean, it's a series of jobs, but the career itself is very unstable, very short-lived. Most models are finished by the age of 24, 25. For women, a little bit longer. For men, it's similar to occupations like sports, these kinds of markets where people sell their bodies, which inevitably that runs out.
If you pay a visit to shopping centers in metropolitan cities, you will see products that are the same in quality and are sold at dramatically higher prices. But where, how, and by whom are these expensive brands manufactured? In 2013, the deadliest industrial incident occurred in the fashion industry, where the Rana Plaza building in the Bangladeshi capital Dhaka collapsed.
In April 2013, there was a six-story building in Bangladesh, just in the outskirts of Dhaka. And despite the fact that it was clear that the building was unsafe, the workers had spotted cracks in the building the day before. They were ordered to re-enter the building and continue working.
1,138 people were killed, and hundreds more were injured. Search and rescue operations lasted for a month, in the hope of finding possible survivors under the rubbles. Around half of the victims were female workers, whose children were kept in the same building. The products of some of the most renowned brands were manufactured in this factory.
It was a predictable disaster. Many of us had kind of, you know, almost tragically waiting for it to happen. There had been others. There had been the Tazreen fire only, you know, 1 year before, in which hundreds of people died. So it was inevitable. It is a symptom of broken chains. It is a symptom of an industry that has lost common sense and that has lost any sense of transparency. You know, many brands who actually were operating in Rana Plaza didn't even know that they were operating in Rana Plaza. And many brands that didn't produce in Rana Plaza thought that maybe they were producing in Rana Plaza.
The fashion show, or the fashion week, is held annually in early January in the US and Europe. The fuss and fanfare of the Fashion Week are associated with some unfavorable dimensions, which usually go unnoticed. One such adverse aspect is the exploitation of tailors and workers of the fashion industry, who work in the toughest conditions in countries like Cambodia, India, Bangladesh, and Thailand.
It's a significant issue, and it's an issue that is very much demonstrative of neocolonialism. This is, you know, we've seen the endless extraction of labour and mineral wealth from these countries for the benefit of colonial countries, and this in many ways is an extension of that. And I think the fact that it's normalised is in many ways representative of that understanding that we can expect less for the lives of people in the global south.
Primark, Chanel and New Look were among the prominent brands produced in the Rana Plaza. The shop belongs to Primark, which has hundreds of branches around the world. In recent years, this brand has made rapid advances. Primark finally surrendered to the pressures exerted by the media and ethical fashion activists and was forced to pay £6 million to the survivors of the Rana Plaza incident. Despite many efforts, the authorities of this company rejected my requests for an interview.
This has been going on for a very, very long time, child labour. And it's extremely unfortunate. There needs to be more regulation on how the companies in overseas companies, when they are the manufacturers, on who is actually being employed.
The collapse of the Rana Plaza ignited protests against the fast, unethical fashion. Initially, the rallies were limited to the collapse of the building, but then they rapidly snowballed into bigger movements, such as Fashion Revolution. Ms. Orsella is one of the pioneers of this international campaign.
What do you mean by fashion revolution?
Fashion revolution wants to see an industry that values people, profit, the environment, and creativity in equal measure. And we believe that it is our collective responsibility to make that happen. We need a fashion revolution because the fashion industry is incredibly powerful. And it can carry a powerful message. It can really be an instrument for change, for positive change. It can really be a force for good.
But how does unethical fashion affect the minds of individuals? What damages does the fashion industry cause to people who work in the industry, especially the models? I found it necessary to ask the opinion of a psychologist on the matter. Sometimes we see that people who work in the fashion industry, especially the models, suffer from serious damages. What kind of psychological impact do these damages have on the lives of those people in the future?
It's not natural for most women to be this skinny. It's not natural. There's some people who are naturally skinny, and then the rest of the models have to take different types of drugs to stop them from eating. They want to give energy. And I mean, alhamdulillah, I got out of this industry after 4 years, but if I stayed in and I kept taking these like drugs to stop me from eating, then it might have had really bad impact on my health, which I think already it has, you know, like some of the health problems that I have. I think this is probably from taking these drugs in the past to stop me from eating.
Karima is one of the models who survived malnutrition. But Isabella Caro did not stand a chance. The French model was among the models who sustained a disease called anorexia, or the decreased sensation of appetite. This disease is widely common among young models. But who is responsible for such problems? Who makes decisions for societies by controlling the fashion industry?
The thing that really struck me the most when I was on a recent trip to Bangladesh is that the workers themselves have a very clear analysis of the fact that the main beneficiaries are definitely the global apparel companies, despite the fact that they're working at a grassroots level to collectively bargain within their own factories. They still feel very clear that the onus and the responsibility for their poor wages and their poor living conditions lie with the global apparel companies.
Sustainability, it's about working with brands, working with governments, working with other NGOs. But I think that we need a fashion revolution because we've shown that certainly the public is ready for change, looking for alternatives, and that fashion can really lead a positive change.
Following the collapse of the Rana Plaza building, there were about 200 global apparel brands that signed the agreement to hold them accountable for safer working conditions. Despite that, many of the American brands refused to sign the agreement and formed their own alliance, which meant that they were not legally accountable for the safety conditions in factories.
Before I started to conduct my research to produce this program, I could not imagine that a simple cover can originate such extensive and complicated issues. Beyond doubt, every human being embeds a crave for color and creativity, which they would like to express in their dressing. But how do profiteers in the fashion industry manage to take advantage of this natural characteristic? Some of the people I talked to in this program were the victims of such profiteering. However, they see a brighter future and believe that if societies become aware of such issues, the beneficiaries will not be able to easily deceive public opinion in order to serve their own interests.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. More and more British people are regretting joining Brexit amid the economic crisis which has plagued the UK. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, a growing number of Brits think the UK was wrong to leave the EU, according to a new poll that was timed to coincide with the 7th anniversary of the Brexit referendum. Based on a survey of 1,525 adults, the poll found that more than 50% of respondents regret Brexit, and only 34% still believe that exiting the bloc was a good decision. Moreover, 78% of the respondents believe that UK should have a closer relationship with the EU in the future. The sentiment is strong even among Leave voters, 71% of whom also favor closer ties with the bloc. Some 43% of those surveyed would like the country to rejoin the EU, while 13% prefer a return to the single market only. Around 20% want closer ties with the countries of the bloc, but not as a member or as part of the single market. Anton Spiask, the head of political leadership at the Institute, said, "Our polling shows that there is a large majority of the British public who recognize that Brexit in its current form isn't working and would like to see the UK moving closer to the EU. This creates a substantial political space to move the debate forward, from refighting the old battles about whether Brexit was right or wrong, to discussing what an improved future relationship with the EU should look like." According to Spiask, the EU will always remain a key strategic ally for the UK. He stated, "It is absurd that the bloc has deeper trading arrangements with Israel and Georgia, better regulatory recognition on food safety standards with Canada and New Zealand, and deeper mechanisms for political cooperation with nations including Australia and Japan." The poll was published as part of a report, Moving Forward, the Path to a Better Post-Brexit Relationship Between the UK and the EU, which analyzes how Britain and the EU could form a closer economic relationship. While not explicitly proposing a return to the bloc, the report highlights a number of technical recommendations that would help the UK cooperate with the EU. These include a voluntary alignment with EU regulations on goods, including product rules and food safety standards, linking the UK's and EU's emissions trading systems, improving mobility for business people, etc. The UK voted to exit the EU on June 23, 2016. In early 2021, the country also left the bloc's single market. Amid the redrawing of trading rules that followed these decisions, the British economy has stagnated. According to the UK's Office for Budget Responsibility, Brexit was directly responsible for a 15% downturn in Britain's trade intensity, a term used to describe a country's access to the global economy. Guardian also noted, on average, just over half of those who did not vote in 2016 say they would vote how to rejoin the EU. It means 51%. Only 1 in 7, 14% would back staying out. The remainder do not express a preference. Evidently, there are some people who now regret not having voted 7 years ago. They are joined by a gradually growing group of those who were too young to vote in 2016 and who, having come of age, are overwhelmingly in favor of being inside the EU. Nearly 4 in 5, about 78% of those aged 18 to 24 say they would vote to rejoin the EU. The 7-year-old Brexit mandate is gradually being overtaken by demographic change. According to new polling by Redfield and Wilton for UK in a Changing Europe, as many as 1 in 3, about 33% of those who voted Leave in 2016 believe that Britain's economy is weaker as a result of Brexit. And although half of this group say they would still vote to stay out of the EU, more than 1 in 3, about 36%, would now back rejoining the EU. Many Leave voters are disappointed too about the perceived failure of Brexit to reduce overall levels of immigration. Strikingly, however, these voters are not particularly likely to have changed their minds about Brexit. Despite its prominence in the EU referendum campaign, immigration is not proving as crucial an issue as the economy in the current Brexit debate.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we try to answer your queries, your issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. And the answers are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified family. Well, today we have the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member at Al Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Yes, thank you very much.
So we have been discussing some of the very important issues regarding the teenagers. And today we want to discuss about the importance of community service. How can parents actually encourage their children to participate in community service activities?
It's a very important issue, as you have mentioned, that our teenagers need to be educated in many things, and one of them is the issue and the matter of taking care of the people in need in society, irrespective of their class and creed and color, their religion, whatever. A community service for mankind, community service for anyone who is a human being, this common bonding between all human beings has to be strengthened, and our children should become aware of this human bonding from a very early age. And in whatever society we live in, if we are living in a multiracial society, in a multi-faith society, or even a single faith society or community, in any case, before we are anything, we are all human beings, and human beings have to live in peaceful coexistence, and they have to live in a society, in a community where they cannot live without each other. They are socially bound together. Everyone cannot do everything. Everyone requires the help of others. Nobody can live in solitary confinement. So nobody can be a hermit. So in Islam, it is very important that we live together as a social community, interacting and helping each other and solving our problems, each other's problems. And this is what has to be inculcated and imbibed in our children, in our youth, in our teenagers, and they should be able to carry out services to the society and the community from the very day they come, they set their foot in public life.
Right.
So they need to be taught, whether it is based around the mosque, the masjid, the place of worship, or it is based around the educational institution we are sending our children to, this community work, or even starting from home, we should be involved in community activities and services.
Right.
And this is very important that our children are taught about Islam. Lays a great deal of emphasis on helping each other and trying to resolve the issues faced by each of us. Somebody is, for example, has monetary problems. We should get together to resolve them.
To help them.
Somebody is facing difficulties in getting a job. We should help to get him or her a job. Or there is someone who needs to lift from one's living to place of work. We can all join in and say, okay, let's have a common way of going to the place of work or the
right.
place of education.
Exactly.
And taking care of, especially going and visiting people who are in need, poor, old people.
Right. Well, Professor, we'll discuss more about that with you after a short break. The listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Professor Salman Nakavi, and we're discussing the importance of community service that should be taught to the teenagers. Well, Professor, you're talking about many of the examples what could be taught as community service. And one of them is like being generous. And Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, if you want to check a believer, a true follower, just to check him at 3 points. It's very strange. We have so many good deeds in Islam, but Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is saying, check a believer at these three places. Just see what he is doing at the time of azan, when a person is called for prayers, what he's doing, if he's engaged in the worldly affairs, or is he preparing for his salat. And then just see what he does with the secrets of others. Does he keep them or does he reveal them? And one of the very important features that he discusses about a believer to check this feature in him is to see how he helps others. If he helps others, see, does he reveal that or does he even keep that within him? Imam Sadiq alayhi salam does not say over here that just see if a believer helps others or not. This is not a question of is he helping or not. There's a question of how he's helping. If he's helping, like today we have, if I help someone, before this help reaches that particular person, it reaches the Instagram, it reaches the Facebook, it reaches the all other social media platforms, just to make this show off that, look, I am helping this person, that person, or I'm doing this particular deed. In this world of media where we have this kind of, I would say it's a war, how do we teach our teenagers this proper generosity that started in Islam?
Yes, the concept of helping others, as it is called, sadaqah in Islam, sadaqah. Even smiling at a person generously is a sadaqah. And helping people in such a way that it is said that if you give through your right hand, your left hand shouldn't know that it has been given.
Exactly.
So the secrecy is there because of the respect and honor that has to be maintained of the person who is being helped.
Right.
A person's honor and dignity should not be trampled upon because of some good deed that we're doing for him or her. It's not for him or her, it's for ourselves. And in the hadith we have before, it reaches the hand of the person who is in need, it reaches out into the hands of Allah Almighty. So the first, Allah Almighty receives that good deed before the person in need does so. So we need to understand that this act of being generous to people, whether it is based on sacrifice, or even where it's not with sacrifice. Even if I'm giving something from the amount of money that I have, and I'm not in need of, I can.
As Allah Subhanahu wa Taala says in Surah Fajr, when I give you, it's a test.
Yes. So, I mean, we sometimes, we've mentioned this before, sometimes we have plenty and we give out from that plenty and we don't need it ourselves. Or we need it ourselves, we partake with half of it or some of it. We are in need of something ourselves, but we give a small amount out of it. But sacrifice is where we even forget ourselves and overlook ourselves. And even the part which we need and the due which is being required by us is also given out to others.
Exactly.
In any case, when we do this act of generosity, it should not be boasted upon. It should not be publicized.
Right, right. I will discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
يا مطي الخيرات يا مطي الخيرات
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said, Honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مطي الخيرات يا مطي الخيرات
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing and we are with Professor Salman Akavi. We are discussing the importance of community service that should be taught to teenagers. Yes, Professor.
Yes, so our children should understand that when they're giving out, they're helping others, they're helping themselves actually. And they need to be... they need to feel for others. They need to. They should not be self-centered. They should not be always looking towards their own needs. So we need our parents to understand that we ourselves, of course, before we want to teach our children and educate our children in being generous, we need to show them how to be generous and how to carry out those acts of generosity. Of course, we may be revealing some secrets to our children, but if it is for the sake of teaching and educating them and providing them examples, it would be okay. But still, you could, I mean, just to show your children, your teenagers, that this is how we give out to others without them being feeling belittled or, you know, they're not there. We need to be very kind to them. We know when we give them something, we shouldn't be boast about it, or we shouldn't
reveal
or even expect something in return from them. The important thing is that
there you go. So it's actually basically when we're posting and when we are sharing things of our generosity, is it because that we want to? We're expecting something in return.
Yes, if we expect something from in lieu of what we have done, then that is something which is forbidden. If we want to carry out a transaction, that is okay. Okay, I'll give you this and you give me that. That's okay. But then don't say that you're being generous.
Right.
Even if you want to, you know, want to give it out to for them to respect you or support you or help you. That shouldn't be the mindset. That shouldn't be the intention. That shouldn't be. It should be purely for the betterment of the person who is in need, to relieve him of the problem that he is facing.
Right.
Yes, Allah Almighty will also, in some way, help us in another way, in another situation. But that should not be the intention. That if we help this person, then he should help us. Or even God should help us. No, it should be irrelevant. It should be important that this is the issue that we want to resolve, whether we gain something out of it or we don't. So, yes, you could say we could at least be looking forward for the reward. Some people say that, like Mawla Ali, alayhi salatu wasalam, says, the master of the faithful says, I pray to Allah, I am obedient to Allah, I follow His commands just because I think...
feel like He is worth of it.
He's worthy of those actions. And basically, any action which is good in itself is something which as human beings we should understand, as our children should understand. Carrying out an act of generosity, carrying out a good deed is basically, essentially, it is a manifestation of our human nature. The human divine nature that has been we have been given by Allah Almighty, we have been honored with this divine spirit, and the result of that is generosity.
Right. Thank you so much, Professor, for that discussion. And I would say that it was the time of Muharram when the young boys in our society would gather, collect money, and get some cold water bottles in the hot, scorching summer and would paste on that. As-salamu ala al-Husayn wa ala Ali ibn al-Husayn wa ala awlad al-Husayn wa ala ashab al-Husayn. Recite this when you have that bottle of water in this hot, scorching summer. And that was one of the beautiful acts of community service. Thank you so much for listening. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.